Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our topic of discussion is director John Carpenter. Joining me are my guests, Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Carl Kafer. Say hello.
Greetings and salutations, everyone.
And Troy Howarth. Say hello.
Hello.
Now, Troy has not been on our show here before. He has guested with Carl on his show. But, Troy, would you like to tell the audience a little bit about yourself before we begin?
Oh, you want to bore everybody right off the top?
Why not?
I've written at this point 14 books. I'm working on a 15th and a 16th. So I've been pretty busy with writing, mostly about European cult cinema, but John Carpenter, who we're here to talk about tonight, has been pretty much a lifelong obsession of mine. So I finally was able to get a book written about him that came out 2 years ago, which I imagine we'll be talking about somewhat. But in addition to writing books, I've also done audio commentaries on about 160 different Blu-ray and DVD releases to date. I've done a lot of writing and a lot of talking about movies.
Very good. I'm looking forward to picking your brain on this. So I will take this to Carl first. So Carl, how did we first come to Carpenter? How did we first come to the movies of John Carpenter?
Well, I don't know how we came to Carpenter, but I can tell you how I came. So I had seen.
Well,
Dark
you know,
Star.
you're always describing yourself as both a cat lover, as both the cat loving Carl and the cheese loving Carl. So I always figured there's two of you.
Well, let's talk about schizophrenia. No, let's not. Okay. Anyway, what I can tell you is that I had seen Dark Star. We had HBO. Early HBO where I lived. But that, I mean, I liked it and so on and so forth, but what really hit me and what made me notice who the director was when I saw Assault on Precinct 13. That blew me away. And the interesting thing is that my father, who is very, very much into Westerns, actually liked that movie, and I didn't realize at the time that it was basically a remake or at least a reimagining of Rio Bravo, and which was one of my dad's favorites. So here my dad, who doesn't like those type of films, and me watching this movie just like enraptured, and I that thing blew me away. And then of course there was Halloween and I was hooked, no question. So that's how I came across Carpenter.
And Troy, how did you come to Carpenter?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it, trying to remember precisely where I first saw anything he was connected with. And I think, funnily enough, the first thing might have been Halloween 2, which, of course, he didn't direct, although he did direct parts of it. As we know, he went in and did some tinkering on the film when the original cut was deemed to be unsatisfactory. But it was the first time I think I can remember seeing a film that he was connected to. He wrote the music for it. He produced it. He co-wrote it. In terms of the movies that he directed, I'm honestly not entirely sure which one was first. It could have been Halloween. But I came to the original Halloween after Halloween 2. So it's all sort of slightly jumbled during that period when I was a very young kid in the early 80s, seeing some of these films for the first time, like The Fog and Escape from New York. But I have a feeling it all started with Halloween 2 and then catching Halloween afterwards.
Yeah, you know, for me, I'm pretty sure, you know, I might have seen stuff when I was really little. I'm 41. That, you know, I might have seen Halloween or clips of Halloween or one of his other earlier movies. But the first one where I remember it and know that it's a John Carpenter film that I had seen all of and really enjoyed. That was Big Trouble in Little China. Now, I know some people hate that movie. I think it's fucking wonderful. But for me, it's going to have to probably be Big Trouble in Little China. So what about you, Aaron?
I mean, by the time I was a kid, Michael Myers was ubiquitous. But I know that the first movie by him I ever saw was Christine, which I saw on TV. And I knew, like, it was one of those movies that my dad was like, hey, this is pretty cool. Let's watch it. He remembered it when it came out. And so we watched that. I think I was kind of just starting to get into Stephen King's books a little bit. And so we watched that and then saw Halloween along the way at some point, finally. And, you know, the rest is the rest.
Yeah, I revisited Christine for this show in prep for tonight, and I have to say, you know, I've always liked it, but somehow I'd forgotten just how much of an asshole the kid had become during that movie. And I don't know how I'd forgotten that. I remembered that most of the people kind of deserved what they were getting, but I think that's a testament both to King's original story, but also Carpenter's ability as a director. So this next question will be for you, Troy. What is the main theme, do you think, of Carpenter's work, if any?
I think there are a few. Part of that is in the title of my book, Assault on the System, The Nonconformist Cinema of John Carpenter, which is a bit of a mouthful. Perhaps it indicates this kind of running theme of you know, basically don't trust the man. Carpenter is from that, you know, generation, kind of that first generation of film directors who came out of film school, and they're film savvy, and they're kind of former hippies, you know, him and Hooper, Wes Craven, George Romero, all these guys are kind of from the same generation. Carpenter's a little bit younger. They've all had this kind of idealism of the 1960s that's been soured. And they've come to realize that their dream of a kind of utopia is not going to be fulfilled. We're getting into the 1980s with the Reagan era and trickle-down economics and everything that, you know, kind of gets screwed up in the 80s and has never really fixed ever since. It's gotten worse. There is this very, very strong anti-authority aspect that runs throughout his films. Don't trust the man. Don't trust appearances. They can be deceptive. And also, I think, a strong theme of embracing being unique, you know, being true to yourself, being true to your vision, being true to your voice, and fighting back against attempts to kind of box you into a corner. You can see that in particular in the two escape films, which are set in these kinds of dystopian futures where, you know, in the case of the second film, we have a kind of Pat Robertson evangelical type president who's been elected for life, which seems terribly prescient now, is kind of making it illegal to be, you know, to be different. You know, you have to be the kind of, you know, WASP kind of figure, very, very, you know, sort of mainstream. And if you're a little bit outside of that, you're going to go to jail. So all those kind of elements are very strong in his films. So there is a strong kind of social and political comment that runs through a lot of his films, even if it's not always obvious.
So, I was actually, when you mentioned that, as you mentioned, I was thinking, yeah, you know, there's elements of that in the two escape films. There's definitely elements of that in Big Trouble in Little China. That's great. Aaron, what about you? What do you think the main themes are?
I can't disagree with anything Troy just said, and it kind of occurs to me that he and Romero especially are kind of like, I don't use this word insultingly, I use it, you know, descriptively, the B film version of the movie Brats of New Hollywood. It's the same crew. It's just that they had more, you know, specialized interests as far as genre goes.
Mm-hmm.
They never really left the Corman School. So anyway, I've always viewed John Carpenter as a very Cold War director. He has more leftist views, but I think his interests are very Cold War oriented. And that goes back to, you know, having a healthy paranoia about everyone and everything around you, not trusting the people who you, because you never know who anybody is, unless they're you. And even then, you're not quite sure in the case of, you know, some of his later work, like In the Mouth of Madness.
Oh, yeah.
So just don't trust anyone, ever.
Now to you, Carol.
I think what I can boil it down to three words. Don't trust appearances. I mean, think about it for a second. You've got, you know, the escape films, which we've talked about. You've got The Thing. You don't trust appearances in that. Okay. Christine, you don't trust appearance of the car. You know, it's going to change you. It's going to trick you.
Look at
Starman.
The Hidden World and Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And you can even go cigarette burns. Don't trust film. Don't trust what you see on film.
Yep.
You know, and I think that's what it comes down to. Don't trust appearances. Don't trust anyone. And this sense of paranoia and that in Carpenter's films is extremely apparent. So the way that he does it, it's an underlying theme. It's not like pushed in your face with the exception of They Live, but that's so satirical that it works. Okay. So yeah, don't trust appearances.
Yeah, you know, but I think Assault on Precinct 13 definitely is an interesting one because, you know, you have the people you obviously can't trust, you know, the ones that are outside trying to kill you, but you don't necessarily want to trust some of the people inside, and yet, but we'll get into that a little later. So. Aaron, now you get yours, and that is this.
Sounds like a threat.
Do we prefer early Carpenter or later Carpenter? And let's make the demarcation point Prince of Darkness. So do we prefer him up to Prince of Darkness or post-Prince of Darkness?
Definitely early. I mentioned specifically that he feels very Cold War director. And once the Cold War was over, I think he kind of floundered for his themes a little bit. I'm not saying I didn't like his post Prince of Darkness films. In the Mouth of Madness and Village of the Damned especially are two of my favorites.
Really good.
He definitely was feeling out something, like something was missing in his work that like was never missing in the early films. Even the ones I didn't like, there was something there that was missing in the older ones.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
definitely the early work.
Carl?
It's easy, early. I will say this, as far as his later work, I think both Escape from L.A. and particularly Ghost of Mars, I don't understand why they have such a bad reputation. Okay, you can laugh at Ghost of Mars all you want. I'll defend it. I don't care. But the thing is, I think you're right in terms of the Cold War, or something happened where it just, you know, it turned into like he was just doing it out of duty, as opposed to really being, you know, entranced in the film and also the message. However, even in his later stuff, the man's a real technical, well done technically, and so on and so forth. But yeah, early, easy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Troy, and I have to say, I agree. It's definitely his earlier work. It's not that there aren't, you know, three or four films I really enjoyed from his later work, but for me, all his best stuff is in that first half of his career. So, Troy?
It's interesting you make the demarcation Prince of Darkness, because most people seem to think, you know, he kind of quote-unquote lost it after They Live. That seems to be the one that most people jumped off the ship after that. I'm not sure, you know, but that was part of the same deal. It was, you know, it was a deal that he made with a company called Alive Entertainment, and they made these low-budget films where he had total creative freedom. Then after that, there's a little bit of a break, and he comes back and, you know, he has a new crew, which I think is part of the reason the film's still different. There is a definite shift in the personnel that happens after a certain point. He's working with different people.
That's interesting.
The situation is changing somewhat. I don't think you're going to find anybody that's going to argue, unless they're just foreign contrarians, I don't think you're going to find anybody that's going to argue that the best stuff came last. It patently doesn't. But I do think that the later films are a lot better than they're often given credit for. Again, there's this kind of argument that a lot of people have that after They Live, he just lost it, and everything after that is crap, which I don't agree with at all. I think that's completely unfair. There are only two films he ever made that I don't care for, and out of a full, you know, range of directing a lot of films over a pretty lengthy period of time, that's a good track record. You know, some of them are more flawed than others. Some of them have problems. But there's really, you know, this idea that the later films are that bad or they're that bland or anonymous or whatever. I just don't agree with that. But there's definitely the early
stuff.
Yeah,
you know, that's kind of how I feel about Billy Wilder. You know, there's really only one or two of his movies that I really can't stand.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of them that I have issues with, but I don't think they're bad. But
I think The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes is the best thing that he is my favorite, and that's one of his last.
Oh, I'm so glad to find another Sherlock Holmes fan. I think that's easily one of his top five movies. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's maybe even one of his top three.
Avanti was wonderful.
Oh, Avanti's
wonderful. Fedora is very interesting.
You know, Cameron Crowe loves Avanti.
Yeah.
He thinks it may be Wilder's most complete film.
Yeah, well, I think anybody should like Avanti, but I mean, that's just me. But I mean, most directors kind of have ups and downs, and they'll occasionally hit sort of bad patches or something like that. But I really don't think that Carpenter's filmography is nearly as uneven as some people make it out to be. There are a couple of duds along the way, but the early films, they're more unified, I think, because again, he has the same people working with him all the time. They had this kind of shorthand that they worked well together. And there was a drive there that I think was very passionate, and he was really determined to try and make his mark. Whereas later on, perhaps things had shifted a little bit and he became a little bit more sort of cynical in some respects. But no, I mean, the early stuff's better, but the later stuff's not bad.
Yeah. So now I hate to say this. We had such a good conversation there. Has everyone had a chance to answer this question, then?
Yes. Oh, wait, Carl. Yes. No.
Carl,
yeah.
Did you get a chance
to
answer this question?
Yep,
that's what I thought. Okay, so we will go on. So I think we will go. Actually, you know what? We'll go back to Aaron. So, Aaron, let's go to this. What do you think is Carpenter's greatest strength as a director?
John Carpenter makes the tightest films I've ever seen. The man never hit 2 hours. And he squeezes out every second of every film, even the films I don't like as much. He does not waste a frame. He gets every feeling of horror and terror and suspense and action out of every single frame that he puts into his film. And that you can't say that about everybody.
No. I mean, look, the only other director that really doesn't really keeps his films short would be Woody Allen, but we all know that Woody Allen's films, the last 20 or 30 years, oh, good Lord, lots of wasted space. Woody should have studied Carpenter and learned how to not waste time. Yeah, total agreement there. Troy, what do you think his greatest strength is as a director?
Well, I like what Aaron said as far as economy goes. I think that's true. Although, personally, I don't have a problem with movies that are, you know, in excess of 3 hours. It depends. I mean, something like The Irishman, 3.5 hours. It could have been longer. I loved it. I have no problem with the movie that goes on. But economy is something a lot of filmmakers today could learn from, especially younger filmmakers who, you know, some of these films that come out like Terrifier 2 and things that are 2.5 hours, and you think, my God, does this really need to be that long? Not to say anything against it. Sometimes I wonder, you know, is it always really necessary for movies to be as long as they are? But I think another aspect I really value and really appreciate about him is how unpretentious he is, both as a filmmaker and as a person. Having had the opportunity to interview him, you know, to sort of pick his brain a little bit, this is a guy who just, he sees himself as an old-fashioned artisan. He doesn't see himself as an artist. He doesn't see himself as an intellectual, although he's extremely bright. He's extremely well-read, but he's just a really down-to-earth kind of a person who just talks about it in terms of craft. It's kind of Howard Hawks. I mean, Howard Hawks, everybody knows John Carpenter worships at the altar of Howard Hawks in the way that Billy Wilder worships the altar of Ernst Lubitsch. So he's somebody who really has modeled himself on that old school style of filmmaker that we don't see today. It's very, very rare. People take themselves so seriously, and they're so, you know, sometimes so pretentious, but that's never true of him. Carpenter may sometimes make films that aren't very good, but he can never be accused of taking himself too seriously on that level.
Carl?
Okay, so what I have to say is connected to what everyone said, economy, but I want to bring it up in terms of orchestration. Let's not forget that Carpenter is a musician, right? And so if you take a look at some of his films as compositions, you've got a sense of editing. You've got a sense of economy, as we've talked about, but you've got a sense of dynamics and rest spaces and so on and so forth, and then a sudden jolt, which happens in the back of the screen, you know, and the background as opposed to the foreground. I take very, very much this from both Assault and Halloween. Halloween is just so perfect in the way that the whole film is put together and orchestrated. And I think being a musician, he thinks in those terms. I don't know if that's true, Troy, but it certainly seems to me that he thinks in those terms. So that's what I would say.
I would just piggyback on that real quick to say that, and we may come into this, I don't know. I don't know if you plan to talk about these at all, but his association with the recent Halloween sequels, which have been controversial, and some people have liked them, some people haven't. I'm somewhere in between. The thing that comes out of those films is that a director like David Gordon Green has clearly studied his work very well. He understands his use of framing, and he's able to copy it sporadically very well, but he doesn't have that timing. And so every time Green, and he's not the only one, there are many other directors who do this, they try to do these jolts, these jump scares, and they don't come off, they don't land, because the timing is off. And I've always said, I think the reason the Carpenter's jump scares work, and they work on repeat viewings. I've seen these films sometimes excess of 10 times. I know what's coming and still makes me jump, is that perfect sense of timing, which, yes, I would agree is an outgrowth of his background as a musician.
Yep. You know, and it's interesting that you mentioned that. Probably one of the best examples of, it's not exactly a jump scare, but it basically is, it of all things, it is when the Firebird comes out of its chrysalis in the Firebird suite in Fantasia 2000. That moment of eruption combined with the musical cues, I've seen that movie about 10, 12 times. Every single time, from the time I first saw it on an IMAX screen when it was new till the time I saw it about 2 years ago, I know it's coming. Every single time, boom. And, you know, there's something to be said for a director or a team that can achieve something that still affects you even though you know it's coming.
Yeah.
So, Troy, how about this? What do you think his greatest weakness is as a director?
That's a tough question to answer. I mean, I think in a kind of generalized, just personal sense, in terms of what happened to him after a certain part in his career, was he pushed himself too hard for too long. And so really, truly anymore, he just doesn't have the energy. He likes to tease in interviews, oh, I'm thinking about doing this, and oh, I may do something. I don't think he's going to. And he doesn't have to. He doesn't owe anybody anything. But I think, you know, one of the things that I really emphasized in my book was how really hard he worked for how long. I don't think people realize all the time how tirelessly he was pushing himself for years and years and years and years, directing films, writing films, composing the scores, you know, and to say nothing of time lost on projects that came very close to being made that didn't end up getting made. So I think in a way he burned himself out too young, because he was only about 50 when he stopped making films, you know, pretty much officially came back later, did a couple episodes of Masters of Horror, did a little movie called The Ward, which when I asked him about that film, he pretty much said, well, they talked me into doing it. I didn't get the impression it was something he really wanted to do. Although it's an interesting film, but it's like you can't keep that up forever. And that was the thing he told me, was when he saw the footage of himself working on the music of Ghosts of Mars, and he said, "Oh my God, I look terrible. But if I keep doing this, I'm going to die." And funnily enough, Dario Argento in his memoirs talks about seeing Carpenter around that time and seeing him and thinking, "Oh God, he looks terrible. He looks like he must be really ill. I hope he doesn't die." Because they're friends, you know, they've been friends for a long time and they admire each other's work. They really burnt himself out. So that's on a kind of personal level, I guess. In terms of making films, I mean, I don't really have a major problem with it in general. I think we could argue that maybe sometimes the characterizations can be a little bit on the thin side. They tend to be more along the lines of archetypes as opposed to really layered, nuanced characters. But on the other hand, that tends to work in his films. He constructs them in such a way that they can work with archetypes. So I could see where that could be a little
underwhelming.
Yeah, I know
some people call it cartoony, but I don't think it's exactly cartoony
It's not cartoony. No, it's not cartoony. It works. I think it's something
I like to call it functional, that his characters are there to function. And you know, he's not a director and a writer that seems to be as interested in character as he is in other things. Now, that's not to say that he doesn't have interesting characters, but you know, character is kind of secondary in some of his works to other interests, and that's totally fine. You know, it works for what he does, for what he achieves.
Yeah. Action, mood, atmosphere, suspense, movement, things like that. are more interesting to him. And that's totally valid. There's nothing wrong with it. I suppose if you were going to say, well, what's a weakness? Well, I guess you could say that. I mean, if you're looking for something a little bit deeper with character, you're not always going to get that in his films.
Yep. So, Carl, what about you?
I really can't say like Troy. I do think that some of his – that he has to be invested in a film. And I think there are certain films that he's not invested in. And I see that personal investment, and a lot of it has to do with him working so hard that you get so tired and that. So I understand that point. But I think he really has to be invested in a film. And I think that's his main thing. If he's talked into doing the ward, if he's talked into God Help Us, well, what's the name of that? Oh, shit. No, I forgot. Sorry, kids. Just a second. The one with Chevy Chase.
Memoirs
of
Invisible
Man. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. You talked into that. And I think also part of that is because Troy brought this out, that he had switched personnel, but also he was not doing things independently anymore. He was doing things within the whole movie business and the all of that and the studios, and you know they put pressure on him, and that I think really demarcates a switch in his films too, and that's why I think most of us, you know, or all of us in this case, you know, think his early films are better because they were more personal. He was more personally involved and committed to. So that's what I would say.
Yeah. Aaron?
That his career didn't end after Vampires. That's all I've got. I think Vampires would have been the perfect ending for his career. That he came back and made two of the very worst movies of his career just is tragic. That's where I'll leave it.
Well, then you're going to love this next question, and it's going to go to Carl. And Carl, which film of his just does not fucking work for you? And I think we all know.
Do I have to repeat it? Memoirs.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit.
I went to see that with my fiance at the time. We didn't actually end up married, and was probably a good thing because she loved this movie, and it's like, why am I here? John Carpenter, what the fuck did you do? Or didn't do?
That's a paycheck movie.
That is just an absolute travesty, and it is such a shame. Because it does, you know, I mean, he's doing his take on Invisible Man. I like that, but you know, from what I understand, the studio basically wanted Chase, and he did not. I think that's what I heard. The one good thing about that movie is he got a friend in Sam Neill, which is about the only thing about that movie that's worthwhile, except for Stephen Tobolowsky. But seriously.
Stephen Tobolowsky is always great.
But that, to me, is the worst of the worst. I like The Ward much better than this. Much better. So there you go.
You know, I was actually just going to say I've been a fan because if I remember right, Stephen Tobolowsky was in Great Balls of Fire, and of course, Jerry Lee Lewis just passed away, so there's that.
Yeah,
that's how far back my awareness of Tobolowsky goes. So, Aaron, what do you think his basically his worst movie is? You going to concur with Carl?
Allow me to preface this by saying that I did not actually I couldn't get myself to watch it, Memoirs of Invisible Man. So I guess that's the worst by default because I couldn't even do it.
Had you seen it once and just not revisited it?
For everything I'd read about the movie, I could just not get myself to sit down to it. It was civil disobedience.
I like that.
I will say of the movies I've seen, which is, I think, all the rest of them, to say Dark Star is his worst is unfair, but kind of true. But Ghosts of Mars, man, is just, of his movies that, you know, had any budget, is just absolute garbage. From start to end, the acting is bad, the story's bad, the special effects are bad. The fact that I finished this movie tells you how, A, invested I was in this project, and B, how horrible the things I've read about Memoirs of Invisible Man are, because I didn't even bother with that one. So.
Oh, Memoirs is unwatchable. The thing is for me, now I'm no great fan of Ghosts of Mars. I think Ghosts of Mars is a bad movie. But here's the thing. I think Ghosts of Mars has some material in it and has some moments in it where had it leaned a little more into where I thought it was going to go, had it been able to capture more consistently the Carpenter flavor that didn't quite show up, I think it could have been a good movie. Maybe not one of his great movies, but it could have been a fun, entertaining movie. And I largely found myself just uninterested in what was going on. You know, people say, oh, it's a confusing movie. I wasn't confused by it. I was just kind of not giving a shit. You know, now Dark Star, I think it's correct to say it's unfair. You know, it's such a low budget movie, So Troy, what about you?
Well, there are only two of his films I have no affection for, and that's Village of the Damned and Ghost of Mars. I am going to stand up for Memoirs on a couple of levels. It was not a paycheck movie. It was a film that passed through the hands of a lot of directors. It was a big literary project, a book that Chevy Chase became very passionately involved in developing as his big kind of breakout movie to become a leading man after being a comedy star throughout the 80s. And it was attached to Richard Donner. It was to Ivan Reitman. It was attached to a bunch of different people. And Carpenter was brought in basically on Chevy Chase's recommendation, funnily enough, as a, you know, he could be an interesting choice. He could bring out the darker elements in the story. The problem with the movie is Chevy Chase wanted to make one movie, John Carpenter wanted to make a different movie, and there's a very unhappy compromise. If you look at it somewhat fairly, it's actually beautifully shot by William Fraker, the great cinematographer who worked on Rosemary's Baby and various other films. And that
collaboration and also Finding Sam Neill were the two things that Carpenter was happy with that film. Otherwise, it's a movie he doesn't want to talk about. He had a very, very difficult time with Chevy Chase on that movie. So it wouldn't be fair to say it's a paycheck film. It wouldn't be fair to say it's a paycheck film because that implies he approached it cynically, which he did not. I think he really did hope and intend that it was going to be a good film. I think he went into it with great positivity and great, you know, noble intentions, but he just found himself being beaten down constantly by Chevy Chase, who was the star and also the producer. So it's the only film that he directed after Assault on Precinct 13. It doesn't have his name above the title. That was deliberate. And he realized that this isn't my film anymore, so he didn't claim that kind of authorial credit on it. It's
not bad. I think to say it's unwatchable is really, it's a bit over the top, honestly. There's certainly far worse films that both that Carpenter made and also that Chevy Chase made, Lord knows. I'll defend it slightly. It's not a great film, but it's hardly, you know, the worst film ever made. But I don't much care for Village of the Damned. I think Village of the Damned was a movie that he really didn't want to make. That was a film that came about because he owed a movie to Universal. He was very keen to do a remake of Creature from the Black Lagoon. He had developed a script. Rick Baker had developed an updated Gillman costume. Everybody was very excited about it. It was going to be a big film. That was the problem. It was going to be a big film. And Universal wasn't willing to put that kind of money into it. They told him, no, we can't back you at whatever the figure was. We can back you at this figure. And they said, no, we can't do it. So they said, well, you're going to have to make something else. You want to do Village of the Damned. Okay. All right. You know, so he does it. If you watch the first half of the film, the setup is actually pretty good. It's got some good things going on, but then it just totally turns to shit after that, in my opinion. Turns into a complete travesty after that. So it's a film I'm not very fond of.
Blackout's actually not bad.
The early part of the film, I think, is quite good. It really does set up a nice atmosphere. But then Kirstie Alley shows up like she's in a different film, and she's terrible in the film. Christopher Reeve is really good in it. I'll give him that. And it has its moments, but I would agree probably overall Ghosts of Mars is pretty indefensible. Although, again, I don't want to sound like I'm just making excuses for the man. I think part of the problem, the big part of the problem, is by this stage he's worn out. He just doesn't have the energy anymore. And it was a tough film to make. If you think it looks cheap, bear in mind.
That's interesting that you – if I can interrupt there, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because that occurred to me. I said, was he tired? Was he getting uninterested? Did he just not? I said, had he started to lose his touch? I mean, you know, it felt like a movie that the only way I can describe it is, have you ever tried to read a book and you suddenly find yourself reading the same page three or four times and saying, wait, I really need to go to bed? It felt like that was the type of thing that was happening for Carpenter. Like he just couldn't quite get his hooks on the material.
It feels like a first draft, and it feels very incomplete. And if it looks cheap, bear in mind how cheap it really was for the scope and ambition of the project. It's an ambitious film for such a small budget, and that's part of the problem. Maybe if he had done it when he had his top collaborators with him, maybe when he was younger and he had more energy, he could have pulled it off. But by this stage, with him being the way that he was at the time, I just don't think it really works very well. And a big part of the problem, too, was an unlucky production because the casting got all screwed up. It was originally supposed to have different actors. Things got shuffled around. You ended up with Ice Cube, who was terrible in the film. And it lacks everything that you would hope for. It lacks the energy. It lacks the clarity. And it just ends up being a bit of a messy film. It's not completely worthless, but it's pretty bad.
Yeah, no, it is.
Can I interrupt here for a second? Because I need to. Okay? All I'm going to tell you is this about Ghost of Mars. I was seeing a woman at the time with two boys. They were, I think, 12 and 9, if I remember correctly. And so I rented this movie because they loved horror movies and they loved John Carpenter. These two boys watched that, I think, within the week over 14 times, like at least twice a day. They watched. They loved it. And I would watch it with them, too. Now, I will say that, yes, Carpenter's tired. Get that. Ice Cube, not so good. But let me tell you something. Seeing the reaction from those boys' faces and how much they loved it, you know, Carpenter still had it. Maybe this is, you know, because of all the situation, him being tired and that, it only really connected with younger viewers. Maybe that's it. But what I can tell you is this, from their reaction, you know, and also, let's face it, you got Jason Statham and fucking Pam Grier in the cast. I don't care how tired they are, I'm there. Okay, so for me, it's not a major film of his, not a great film by any means. Will I watch it again? I watched it about 2 years ago. I'm going to watch it again. So there. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just Kyle, I can say so much about some of those 70s movies you like, but we'll leave it be. So, yeah. I guess I will take this one to Aaron. And the question is going to be, what do you think is his underrated gem? You know, this could be one that maybe it ends up in your top five, or maybe it's outside the top five, but you really think it's worth noting. It's something that you love and that you think not enough people think of or think highly of, and you think they should become more aware of it.
I'm going to say this one because it's the only one in my top five that's from after the late period starts. So In the Mouth of Madness really took me by surprise.
Yeah.
It was a really, really fantastic movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you stole mine. So I guess we'll go right back to Carl. Carl, what's your underrated gem?
I got to go with Assault. I think not many people have seen it as much as the other films. I think really from Halloween on, everybody knows it up to basically like Prince of Darkness and They Live. Okay, and they know all those films. But a lot of people don't know Assault. And I got to say a couple things about that. It's just so, so shocking when they kill the kid. Okay, that's a jaw drop that he's never surpassed, ever. Number two, Austin Stoker, who just passed away, is so good. And even better, Darwin Johnston. Those two, I don't see how they didn't get major, major careers out of that, because they are just phenomenal. Everybody in that film does their job. It is so fucking tight. There's not one wasted moment. The score is absolutely friggin' fantastic. I put that up against Halloween any day. And you know, when you talk about what our best film is, I'll shut up because you basically know. I think Assault on Precinct 13 is absolutely fucking brilliant. And I think more people need to see it. So that's what I have to say.
Yeah. Troy?
That's a tough question to answer because so many of his films didn't do well when they first came out. It's kind of the tragic story that happens over and over again. Many of them do indifferent or just downright bad business. And then 10 years later, people start saying, oh, boy, I really like that one. So it's hard to say. I mean, I think there was a time when a movie like Christine was underrated, but nowadays it doesn't seem to be. I mean, it seems to me that people really like it a lot. I think maybe in a way I would point to Cigarette Burns because it's a late period work. It's his first episode of Masters of Horror, which are short films. It's not quite a feature, but it's an hour, so it more or less counts. And it's a terrific piece of work that I think you know, it did get good reviews at the time. It had one of the better, stronger responses from people out of that run of the series, the first season. So I don't even know if that counts as such because it was fairly well received by the target audience. But I tend to think it's a movie that doesn't get talked about as much as it should. I think another one we can point to is Starman, which is actually one of his biggest box office hits. It was a huge hit in the 80s. It got good reviews. It got an Oscar nomination for Jeff Bridges. I mean, it was a mainstream popular hit, but people don't seem to talk about it.
I know my mother still loves that movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it shows a softer side to Carpenter that people aren't used to, because a lot of his films are very testosterone-heavy films. You know, he famously makes a film like The Thing, which is all men, and they tend to be movies about men doing men things. And this is a movie that's kind of a little bit softer. Him kind of almost kind of like he's answering the critics after The Thing. Everybody was blasting the movie when it came out and said how disgusting it was. well, here, we can do a friendly alien invasion story, and I can show you my soft side. So maybe that one, to an extent, could be counted as an underrated one, too.
Aaron?
I already answered this one.
No, I thought you had something to add.
Oh no, I just laughed. I thought his what he said was funny.
Okay.
His close
encounters. So then we will go to the next question. And that will go to Carl, and he will be the one to start us with our top five films. Now, the way we're going to do the top five films is this: we're going to do it old-fashioned Siskel and the Ebert style, where we count from five to one. So we're going to start with you, Carl. Then we'll go to Troy, then to Aaron, then to Troy. So, Carl, Aaron, Troy. So, Carl, your number five film.
I don't have it written down, but I'm going to say Big Trouble in Little China, which I love. I love Big Trouble in Little China. I love the fact that Kurt Russell is a John Wayne wannabe who ain't. Okay? I love James Hong and all that, and it's just so much fun. And Dennis,
I love the fact that it's a movie about a sidekick who doesn't realize he's the sidekick.
The sidekick. Okay. The other thing I got to say is the last the theme song, which you hear over the theme credits, the Kupka Bills are so fucking great. That song is just magnificent, and the video is even better. I love that movie. I adore it. And that scene in the elevator.
You know, I'm not sure if it's his best movie, but it's probably my personal favorite, the one that I've seen the most and personally enjoy the most. But yeah.
I think it's actually his most enjoyable film. The one that you just have fun with. Right?
It very well could be.
Yeah.
So that's Aaron. Five. Aaron, you're number five.
Assault on Precinct 13.
Nice.
Assault on Precinct 13, I don't know if you heard me.
Yep.
Which, I don't know why, but to me, it's like the best zombie movie without zombies ever.
Absolutely.
To me, it has a very George Romero feel to it. Maybe it's because of Dawn of the Dead. And a similar scenario with the shopping mall to the police station. I don't know. But to me, it feels very much like a zombie apocalypse film, but isn't at all. And, it is everything Carl said it is.
Well, it's a terrific movie. I mean, it's way up there for me. So what about you, Troy? Number five?
I'll go number five would be the number one for a lot of people, which is Halloween. I love Halloween, of course. It's one of the emblematic modern horror films without a question, and it manages to do that without really showing any blood. It's all about suggestion. It's all about timing. It's all about atmosphere. And it really, in a way, it's him taking the Italian giallo films that he had enjoyed, particularly the work of Dario Argento, and stripping it down to the bare minimum and just making it into a perfectly sort of oiled scare machine. And it holds up. I mean, all these years later, 44 years later, we're still talking about it. It's still being sequelized, and it has never been topped.
So now number four, Carl.
I'm going to go with The Thing. I was at the theater in New York when I saw that. And I will tell you this. When that head comes out and sprouts the spider legs, everybody in the theater basically said it in unison. What the fuck? Along with the acting. I'm not kidding about that. In many ways, that's, to me, that's not a John Carpenter film. That's a Rob Bottin film. Seriously. I mean, the special effects are just amazing. And I was disgusted.
All the makeup special effects are
phenomenal. I was shaken. It has a wonderfully downbeat ending. And I will tell you this, no wonder it did not do well because of two things. Of course, it was up against E.T. Everybody wanted to feel good. Nobody wanted to feel defeated, right? But my God, what a film. And that's my number four.
Aaron?
Prince of Darkness. This whole trilogy, I guess it's a trilogy of sorts, kind of an H.P. Lovecraft trilogy. But we'll get into that. Really, really just excited me from start to finish. Each of the three films I will be mentioning very soon. This was the middle installment. But the way that he incorporates, his films are not very religious in nature, which is interesting because he is a horror film director, which usually horror relies heavily on like religious imagery and mythology and stuff, but his don't. But this one, the way he uses the church and Catholic tradition and stuff is very just fantastic.
Troy?
My number four is Cigarette Burns, which I mentioned before, his first segment of Masters of Horror. I can't hardly convey the excitement and joy that I got out of that when I saw it for the first time. As a matter of fact, I watched it again right away because after having seen Ghost of Mars and thought, I just don't know. I don't know if you still got it in you or not. And seeing this beautifully executed little gem of a horror film made for TV, it was like, okay, you're not working in Panavision. You don't get your widescreen vistas up there, but everything else is here, and it just works so, so well. It acts as a kind of a postscript to that trilogy, the Apocalypse trilogy, that has been alluded to. And it definitely fits into that sense of a world gone completely crazy and deranged where anything is possible. And I love it dearly.
Carl, number three?
Number three has to be Escape from New York. I think the character work in that is really, really good. You've got great actors. You've got Harry Dean Stanton. You've got, of course, Kurt Russell, Lee Van Cleef, Ernest Borgnine, you know, and just incredible. And the guy from Shaft. Help me.
Isaac Hayes.
Thank you.
Isaac Hayes. Yeah.
Thank you. And I was just at the Stax Museum. Fuck. Anyway, really, really good character work. I loved everything about it. It was just, you know, the thing about that film for me is the setting, the idea of New York being a prison. Now, I'm right outside of New York now. I live in Elmont, right across the Queens border. And trust me, it's still a prison. It really is in a lot of ways. I think I think he was really onto something there. And I really, really like that film. I love, you know, the idea of Snake Plissken. And I by the way, I want to know what the fuck happened in Cleveland. I don't know about you guys. I want to know what happened in Cleveland. Yeah, I love that movie. Absolutely freaking love that movie.
Well, I'll tell you what happened in Cleveland. Somebody
okay.
fucked up the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Snake didn't like it, and he made them pay.
Okay. Well, I hope he killed John Winter. Anyway, there you go.
Okay. So, Aaron.
In the Mouth of Madness. The quintessential 90s Stephen King novel, which never existed, becomes the quintessential Stephen King adaptation that does without the book. This movie is so far over the top that it should not work. And I loved every second of it. Sam Neill sells it to perfection. And yeah, just couldn't get enough of this one.
Troy, your number three?
My number three is actually the same, In the Mouth of Madness. I remember going to see it when it came out in 1995, early 1995. I went to see it with my best friend, and it was bad weather out in Pennsylvania. We nearly bought the farm on the way home, but I somehow felt as though it had still been worth it, even if it had happened, because Carpenter at that point, it had been a little while since he'd made a great film. And I think that was his last great feature for the big screen. I mean, I like Escape from L.A. I like Vampires. But they both have problems. Whereas I think In the Mouth of Madness really works. Yeah, there's definitely a Stephen King vibe, but it's Lovecraft again. It's this kind of thing that he does where he's never done a real Lovecraft adaptation, and yet he has gotten closer to that sense of cosmic horror. And that sense of showing something that is somehow indescribable than just about any other director. I mean, no disrespect to Stuart Gordon or Lucio Fulci, who made films that were very Lovecraftian as well. But Carpenter definitely comes really, really close in a film like this to really capturing that.
Yeah. So now we have number two. Carl?
Well, for number two, I could always say Ghost of Mars. And no.
No, where's my boot button?
But my number two and my number one film can be interchanged. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to go with Halloween for number two. It's damn near perfect. It really, really is. I think it is the tightest, most economical horror film I have ever seen from Carpenter, or basically from anybody. I think everything about it just comes together perfectly. And to me, I remember being in the theater, seeing this with a bunch of people, and it was in Olean, New York. And people were screaming at the same time. People were saying, you know, get the fuck away. Everything. It's perfect. Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Aaron?
The Thing. We're just going to finish off this little trilogy here. It's one of the most paranoid films ever made. Again, he never wastes a frame. Kurt Russell is at his absolute most dynamic. His charisma alone carries the film, and it's a film that doesn't need to be carried by a star. It's fantastic.
It really is. It's a marvel. Troy?
My number two is a film that I didn't care for at first. It took me a while to kind of really be won over by it. I think it, it was a film I didn't get to see theatrically. I wanted to. I very much wanted to go see it. And unfortunately, when it opened, I was sick. And then, you know, it didn't stay in theaters for long. And so for years, I saw it on TV, panned and scanned, and it really kind of ruined the overall impact. And that's Prince of Darkness. When I finally saw Prince of Darkness in widescreen, I was like, oh, wow, you know, this really came to life. It's really one of his best examples of framing in a film. It's such an ambitious concept. It's beautifully shot. And I asked Carpenter and his wife, Sandy, who worked on the film as sort of script supervisor and associate producer, you know, if that posed any problems in terms of the sheer ambition of the concept versus the very small budget. And they both said, no, I mean, you know, we knew what the parameters were, so we planned accordingly. So to do a cosmic story like this, but to set it in a isolated location, a la Night of the Living Dead, or indeed Assault on Precinct 13, is very smart, very economical. The characters are very sympathetically detailed, even if they're not terribly deep. We don't know much about them. There's this kind of running gag about the one character, Susan. They keep saying, you know, who? Oh, the radiologist with the glasses, you know. And there's this kind of, you know, humanity that is in there, in these characters. We care about what's going to happen to them, which is something that's lost in a lot of contemporary kind of, you know, splatterfests and things where very often we don't care about the people at all. We just can't wait to see them be gorily dispatched. So this is a sympathetic group of people that we're very invested in, and it's dealing with quantum physics, and it's dealing with religion, it's dealing with mystery of faith, and, you know, is there anything on the other side, and all this other kind of stuff. It's a really, really ambitious film that was out of step for the 80s because it asked the audience to think. And so, not surprisingly, it wasn't a big hit, although it was cheap. So it made its money back. But, yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to add in mine now. I'm not going to go all the way up to my number one quite yet. But I'm going to say that my number five, I have a tie. I flipped a coin and it fell on its side type deal. My number five is a tie, Dead Heat, between Halloween and Escape from New York. My number four is Assault on Precinct 13, which, you know, Carl's not wrong. It's an awesome, awesome work. My number three is also In the Mouth of Madness, which took me by complete fucking surprise. My number two is probably the film of his that I enjoy the most, and that is Big Trouble in Little China. So with that said, Carl, what is your number one?
You want to take three guesses and the first two don't count?
Assault on Precinct 13, Assault on Precinct 13, and The Simple Dwarf.
No Simple Dwarf. Assault on Precinct 13, I've already talked about it. Go on from there.
Yep. So, Aaron.
A Halloween.
Woo!
The shot of Michael Myers standing in broad daylight outside of a quiet suburban home changed everything about the horror genre. And it single-handedly is responsible, for better or for worse, for the next 2.5 decades of horror films. The score is perfect. He doesn't, again, waste a frame. He gave us Jamie Lee Curtis. And one of the most iconic horror villains of all time. There's nothing in this film that doesn't, you know, deserve to be lauded and put on a pedestal for all to see. It simply is one of the greatest horror films ever made.
Agreed.
It's pretty damn good. Troy?
Well, my favorite is the one that, you know, ironically was bitterly rejected when it came out in 1982, but people love it now, and that's the thing. You know, Carl mentioned E.T. before. The funny story about that is that Universal really thought that the Thing was going to be their big money maker, and they put all their weight behind the Thing, whereas E.T. was just this little film that, oh, okay, we'll let Spielberg do it. We don't really care. They didn't really give him a lot of money to make it. It comes out. It does tremendous business. Carpenter sees this is happening and pretty much goes into panic mode, says, look, maybe we need to rethink this. This is, maybe the Thing isn't a good movie for the summer. Let's put it out over Halloween. Let's rethink the ad campaign. He was never comfortable with Universal drawing parallels with Alien, for example. He hated that. He didn't want there to be comparisons. He thought that the ad campaign wasn't very good. They said, no, it's fine. Everything's going to be good. This movie's going to be huge. It's going to make tons of money. And it flopped. It was an expensive film. You know, I agree with Carl's comment that certainly Rob Bottin deserves a lot of credit, but also John Carpenter deserves an equal amount of credit.
Yeah, a hell of a lot.
For making a masterpiece that is one of the great films about paranoia. It is a great sort of existential film. You know, who are we? What are we? What is a human being? It's a movie that gives you a great deal of ambiguity and refuses to answer a lot of questions, which I love. That's something a lot of his films do. I mean, a lot of people criticize his endings. They'll say, oh, he doesn't know how to end the movie. He actually does. He just likes to kind of leave things a little bit vague, to give people something to talk about. But people don't always like ambiguity, so that bothers people. It's an absolutely remarkable film. And for all the talk about the special effects, which are extraordinary, what he also put together was an amazing cast, an absolutely flawless ensemble, all of whom give fantastic performances. And all these reviews that came out when the movie was torn apart in 1982, virtually all the mainstream critics dumped on the film. Gene Siskel defended it. He was one of the few people who actually defended it. Most everybody dumped on it and said it was a terrible film. It had no humanity. You can't tell the people apart. They went to great pains to make sure that you could tell people apart. Even little details like Richard Dysart wearing a nose ring, for God's sake, which you can't even tell until you see the movie in high def. All these little things, little character quirks and different things that are brought to the table. And I think the characters are quite sympathetic. They're quite human. And we can relate to their situation, which makes it all the more powerful and which makes that last act all the more just devastating. It's just a great film.
It's a very heated film set in just about the coldest place on Earth.
Yeah, well, that's the contrast, isn't it? And that's what works so well. I mean, it's very cold and very chilly, but it's not at all clinical. You do care about these people, I think, and they do register as real flesh and blood human beings. And all the terrible things that happen. And again, the casting is just so perfect. Everybody in that film is so good.
You know, it's my number one as well, and I'll just co-sign on what you said. It's phenomenal. I saw it probably when I was way too little to see it. I was a kid, but I'm also the kid that, you know, went and saw The Last Emperor and The Fly in the theater, and you know, I saw shit I probably shouldn't have seen as a kid, but I fucking loved it. This is just a great movie. This is just a really, really great movie. I think I was probably about 7 when I saw it. But, oh, damn, what a powerful film. And those special effects, yeah, just amazing. So now I'm actually going to ask a question that I didn't get to ask, but it occurs to me is we've got just enough time for me to ask this question, and I'm going to start with you, Aaron. I'm going to go to you. I'm going to ask this question first for you, and that is, who do we think Carpenter's most important collaborator is? Of all the people he worked with, who do you think is his most important collaborator?
Himself. He wrote everything. He directed everything. He scored everything. He edited almost everything. It sounds like a joke. Same time, you know, Steven Soderbergh is also his most important collaborator. So, I don't know. I don't think I can do better than that.
Yeah. Troy?
I like that answer. It reminds me that when Prince of Darkness was coming out, of course, it's very much a homage to Nigel Neal and the Quatermass films, and which he was a big fan of. And he had involved Nigel Neal, actually, in Halloween 3, which, you know, Neal took his name off the film, and the movie was hated for years. But, again, people like it now. But he signed the movie as a screenplay writer as Martin Quatermass. And in the press book, he talks about Martin Quatermass as, oh, he was the easiest guy I've ever had to work with. And he did everything I wanted him to do. So, you know, there's some truth to that. If I were to think outside that a little bit, I would certainly say Dean Cundey, the cinematographer who shot, you know, Halloween, The Fog, Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China. You know, he and Carpenter had a really, really good rapport that I wish they could have carried on, but unfortunately Cundey kind of, you know, he got into working with Spielberg and Zemeckis and doing Back to the Future and really big films, and I think he got priced out of it. So Carpenter moved on to his camera operator, Gary Kibbe, who became a cinematographer for much of the rest of his work. And Kibbe did really good work, too. But when I think of the really iconic images in Carpenter's films, in The Thing and Halloween in particular, Dean Cundey is very definitely a big part of that.
Yeah, yeah. Carl?
Well, I'm going to basically say the same thing as everyone else, but I'm going to put it in a different way. His piano, his composition paper, his mechanical pencil, however he composed. I think, for me, the music and the film and everything that he did was enhanced by what he composed for his films. I think, as a composer, he's his best collaborator, and I can't think of anything else to say about that, really. And again, I'm coming from more of a musical background, but the themes, all the music, the last film I saw in the theater was Baccarat, and he composed a small segment of that score. I knew immediately it was Carpenter. Knew immediately without checking anything. I knew it had to be Carpenter. That's how unique his scores are. That's how wonderful he pairs music with film and with editing and everything. It's just that, and I mentioned that being a musician, it's all about, you know, orchestration. And to me, it's his music, and it's him composing the music. So there you go.
So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the first of the last two questions, and I'm going to collapse one of the two of the questions into one big question, and that is that he's often called a horror director and wears that title proudly, but is that all he is, or is he more? And on top of that, once we figure that out, where do we rank Carpenter among horror directors and all time? So I will go with this large, meandering mess of a question and take it to you, Aaron.
I mean, I think horror is his signature genre, but like George Romero or Wes Craven are guys that worked in horror to a, you know, wider percentage of their filmography than Carpenter. It's hard for me with all three of those guys, actually, but with Carpenter especially, not to just think of them as I said earlier, the movie brat auteurs of the 70s. I mean, what separates John Carpenter from Brian De Palma other than De Palma got shot from the studios? They're auteurs, and whether horror was their main genre or not, it doesn't matter. Of course, Carpenter also made really great action films. He made some decent science fiction. And he played around, but he was a genre filmmaker. He was not, you know, a dramatic filmmaker. And that's where he loses points with some people. That being said, within the horror genre, if he's not the best, he may as well be. I'm not going to sit here and try to, you know, argue his place in the pantheon, because he's there, and I can't think of anyone better, though I think there are several that are on a similar level to him.
So finally, to you, Troy. No, actually, I'll take it to Carl. I want to end with Troy. I want you to have the last word. So, Carl.
Well, you take a look at his filmography. 90% of it is either horror or science fiction. So he's definitely a genre. And when you talk about being a genre director, there's only one other name I would consider putting in with him as far as modern directors, or at least, starting in the late 60s, and that's Romero. So, you know, it's a toss-up to me which one is better within the genre director. I mean, you know, if you want to take a look at where you put him alongside, you know, Altman or you know, Kurosawa or that sort of thing, I think that's unfair. But if you're talking genre, certainly top five, easily, probably top two or three.
Mm-hmm. No, he's one of the greats. So, finally to you, Troy.
I mean, it's hard to think of a director who is just a horror director. I mean, maybe more recently there have been some people who've come along who've really kind of styled themselves as horror directors. That's what they've set out to do. I mean, Carpenter says he started making movies. He wanted to make Westerns. That was what he really wanted to make. He loves horror. He loves science fiction. He loves action. But he always wanted to make Westerns, but Westerns were dying by the time he comes onto the scene. So he makes kind of urban Westerns. I mean, Assault on Precinct 13, Escape from New York, Vampires. And others, they all have, you know, Western elements to them. But, you know, in terms of directors who are horror directors, it's hard to think of anybody that you would say, oh, well, you know, they're just a horror director. That's all they do. That's not true of really, go back to James Whale or Mario Bava or any number of other great directors who've dabbled in the genre, directors like Roman Polanski who've made horror films. But aren't necessarily called horror directors as such.
True.
So he's definitely more than a horror director. It goes without saying, I think that is true. But in terms of his place within the genre, in terms of directors who are really heavily associated with horror films, for me, he's only below Mario Bava, who is my favorite director of all. He's the film artist that means the most to me. So he must reign supreme for me, but he's on a par with people like Lucio Fulci, Dario Argento, Terrence Fisher, James Whale, George Romero, you know, you name them. All wonderful directors who made their mark, and he definitely made his mark in a big, big way.
You know, I have to say, something someone said earlier gets me thinking this, you know, yeah, you can say that he's a genre director, he's a horror director, and that's fine, but he is so much more. There have been times in my film viewing life where I've thought of John Carpenter almost as a genre unto himself, you know. One of my favorite TV and mystery writers of the last 30, 40 years was a gentleman by the name of Michael Malone, and He was an English professor as well as a dramatist, and he once gave an interview where somebody said, how come you don't write like this or you don't write like that? And he was joking around when he said this was also dead serious. He said, well, that's because I don't write like nobody but me.
Mm.
And,
yeah.
You know, there's really nobody that makes a John Carpenter movie except John Carpenter. There are directors out there who've been compared, but not quite. There's only one John Carpenter.
Yeah, people have tried to copy him. I mean, I mentioned before David Gordon Green with this new trilogy. You can tell his heart's in the right place, and he's trying to copy that. He's trying to recapture it, but he can't quite do it. He just doesn't have it. Whatever his own merits are, that's one thing. But, you know, and there are other people too, like with It Follows. It Follows was compared a lot to John Carpenter, and, you know, there's certainly other examples too. And you're right, he is almost his own genre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're kind of winding down here, but we also have plenty of time if we want to have a little bit of a conversation about some other stuff. So before we go and do that, I'm going to ask this question. And it's going to be Carl. Would you like to take us through housekeeping?
I wasn't expecting that right away, but I can certainly do that if you give me a moment.
Absolutely.
But actually, I think before we do that, I think we should talk to Troy and ask him, you know, what's going on in promotion. I just saw that you were going to release The Body and the Whip.
I was going to get to that next, but yeah, okay, sure, we can do that.
Well, first of all, I have a new book out, Make Them Die Slowly, The Kinetic Cinema of Umberto Lenzi, about the Italian director Umberto Lenzi. So that book is now out and available through Amazon in three different versions. They are identical in terms of content, but they are priced in different ways to adjust to your paper, or rather to your pocketbook. There's a cheap black and white edition soft cover. There's a more expensive color soft cover version, and there is a really nice hardcover color edition, but rather expensive. So that's for the more fanatical Lenzi files out there and people who really like hardcover books like I do. So there's that. Commentary-wise, yes, there were just a couple of films announced by 88 Films, a label out of the UK. One of them is quite demented, but rather endearingly trashy and enjoyable Italian zombie film called Hell of the Living Dead, which I did a commentary with Italian film scholar Eugenio Ercolani. That's a 4K UHD release that's coming out in January. And then in March, they're putting out Mario Bava's great gothic psychological ghost story, kinky S&M film, The Whip and the Body with Christopher Lee. In a beautiful new remastered edition, which absolutely blows all other versions out of the water, regardless of whether or not you want to hear me on the commentary with Nathaniel Thompson from Mondo Digital, you will want to see this transfer because it finally restores the colors the way that they should look, and it's a far more satisfying. It looks, I've only seen a standard definition file. That's the funny thing, but I'm telling you, it looks absolutely beautiful. That way I can only imagine what it'll look like when it's all finished in HD. Fans of the film would be aware that the previous Blu-ray versions did not look very good. They were taken from a really shoddy master. It was far too dark and the colors were all wrong. So this is cause for celebration if you're a Mario Bava fan. I'm very proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, Bava's works have always had wonderful photography, you know, and it's nice to see that something like that is finally getting the cleanup it's long demanded.
Yes, it's one of his best looking films. Of course, he was a great cinematographer in addition to being a director, so He handles cinematography on his own films, whether or not he's credited. Sometimes he would credit his cameraman as the cinematographer, but he did the lighting himself. So always had that beautiful look that he did so well. And this is definitely one of his best looking films.
So, is there anything else that you have coming up, Troy, that you want to tell us about? Or, you know, maybe a book of yours that you're especially proud of that you think somebody interested in horror or maybe television or fantasy, science fiction might find interesting?
I mean, it's hard for me to judge because I'm not good at judging my own work. I don't tend to have a great deal of confidence in my own work. I just hope that it turns out well. And many people seem to like it, inevitably some don't, but that's to be expected.
Oh, I know the feeling.
I am very proud of the Carpenter book because it's something I wanted to do for a long, long time. My first book was written actually pretty much started writing it once I was out of high school and then through college. And it came out in 2002 when I was 2 years out of college. And at that time I was planning to do a book on Carpenter and that just didn't happen for a variety of reasons. And it was one of those kind of big, heavy things on my shoulders that I knew I wanted to do it. I had to do it, but I didn't know what was going to happen. So finally it happened, started working on it in 2018. It came out in 2020 and getting to interview the man himself was such a treat. I was incredibly nervous, of course, incredibly intimidated. I'd met him once. He came to Homestead, Pittsburgh, to do a show when he was doing his world tour with his godson and the backup band. They were doing the themes from his film. And that was very nice. But then to sit down and talk with him on the phone was incredibly daunting. But I found him to be a lovely guy. I mean, just, again, very unpretentious, down to earth. Not terribly loquacious. He doesn't really like talking about his own films, but if you get him on other topics, he's a lot more talkative. But he was great. He was very, very kind about the whole thing. And when it was finally done and put out, I felt like, okay, I've done it. Now I can clean it off the slate. So I feel like that was a big, big burden off of my shoulders to get that done. So I'm very proud of that one in particular. Depending on your interests, again, a lot of works about Italian and Spanish horror, Paul Naschy, for example, the Spanish horror king, and Mario Bava, Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci. I've written about all of these people, and it depends on where your interests are, which ones you'd want to check out.
Great. I am curious before we move on towards the end of the show. Did you just do the one interview, or did you do a series of interviews, or was it like split up? But you counted it as one. How much contact did you actually have in terms of maybe hours of interview with him?
I got an hour with him on the phone. I got in touch with him, an Australian film writer, Lee Gambin, had written a book about Carpenter's film Christine, and so he had some contacts that I was able to make use of, was able to arrange an interview, so I did an interview with him. That was about an hour long. I talked to his wife, Sandy, who was also delightful. I mean, she's a lot more talkative. I mean, she's more prone to go on and on than he is. He's pretty to the point and, pretty old school, but she was a lot of fun to talk to. I talked to her for about an hour. And I also talked to Keith Gordon, who played the lead in Christine. And boy, was he a chatterbox. And I mean that in the best possible way. I mean, he was terrific. He told me all kinds of stories and was incredibly, incredibly enthusiastic. So I only got the 1 hour with him, and it was, like I said, it was very daunting. I was really, really nervous about it because I'd heard some people say, oh, he's not very nice and he's just cranky and everything. And I thought, I think I've got this guy figured out. I think he's kind of on the shy side. He's not really somebody who's terribly comfortable being in the spotlight, and he just would rather let the work speak for itself, and he's not pretentious. So you can't really talk to him in those kinds of terms because he's just going to kind of snicker at that. So I knew how to approach him, and he seemed, like I said, he was lovely with me, and hopefully he liked the book. I mean, he was kind enough to take a picture of him holding it, which was great for promotional purposes, and just really one of those all-time geek-out moments for me, for really one of my heroes holding
really
the work that I've written about him. That was, yeah, big thing for me.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. So, yeah, now, Carl, are you ready for housekeeping?
Absolutely. So here we are at housekeeping. And, of course, I just want to say it's wonderful to be here on the show, John Carpenter with Troy and everything. Now, as far as tomorrow is concerned, which is Saturday, we have Rock This Town Radio with TC, and he's going to be doing a whole slew of songs with the words stop and or go in them. And so it's Stop and Go, Rock This Town Radio with TC tomorrow. And then on Sunday, we continue our spooky season, and we have Noel Vera with us. Noel is the premier movie reviewer and historian for Filipino films. And we're going to continue our series of weird horror movies from the Philippines. And that is on Sunday at 8 p.m. Then on Monday, Halloween night, Vicki Love and myself and Rachel will be doing a commentary watch on the remake of 13 Ghosts. That's the 2001 film. And we'll be doing that on Halloween night. Now, Adam, you have something planned, I think, for November 1st, which is Day of the Dead. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, now, people may have noticed that I've always avoided the commentary watches for a variety of reasons. It's not that I don't like them. It's just that I've always thought that I haven't had enough to say that would be that interesting, or maybe I honestly couldn't afford a good enough copy, or something's come up. There's been a variety of reasons. Well, you know, Carl had mentioned he wanted to do something Day of the Dead related, and I only half-jokingly mentioned, well, fuck, why don't we do a commentary watch on the episode Day of the Dead from Babylon 5, which is one of my two favorite science fiction series. And that's what we're going to be doing, folks. We're going to be doing the Season 5 episode Day of the Dead, written by Neil Gaiman, which it was part of the final season of Babylon 5 from 1998. And, yeah, it'll be a TV episode. It'll be a co-production of my show and Carl's show. And that'll be Tuesday. I don't think it'll take too long, but episode's only about 45 minutes. I expect that we'll be on air maybe 60 to 70 minutes total, a little bit of prep, maybe a little bit of discussion afterwards. So please join us for that.
That's
going to
be at 8 o'clock.
Yep, 8
right?
o'clock on Tuesday. Yep.
Okay.
And is there anything else that you have coming up, or should I jump into what we have?
I do have some things in the magic hat that I'm trying to reach for and make sure that they're all set up. That's what we have planned at the moment that's set in stone. So there you go.
Yep, very nice. Well, this show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be coming back in 2 weeks on November 11th with a look at the Danish series for Brittleson, or The Crime or The Killing, which you may know as an AMC series from a few years back. That AMC series, The Killing, was a remake of this, which is the Danish original, which ran for 3 rather incredible seasons. That's coming up in 2 weeks, on the 11th of November. Now, 2 weeks after that, on November 25th, we are going to be doing a look at British director Ken Russell. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Let's watch Ken Russell movies. that's going to be what we have coming up over November for there may, if I can fit in one more episode, there's a great TV show that's about to finish its run, and if I can get the guests together, there may be a bonus episode this coming month, but we'll see how that goes. But I don't want to firm up any, but I haven't firmed up anything. So until that happens, I don't want to do more than just tell everybody, keep your ears open.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, now it's that part of the show where I always like to ask, is there anything that we haven't brought up yet that you'd like to bring up? Carl, is there anything about Carpenter that we haven't mentioned, or his movies, something related that we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up real quick?
Well, okay, I do want to bring this up because this past a couple months ago, we had a biopic, sort of, kind of Elvis, which wasn't nearly as good as John Carpenter's TV. Not even close. You know, and there's so many of the films we haven't mentioned, but there's that one, and God knows, you know, I'll let you guys mention some of the other films. But that particular film, which again was Kurt Russell, that really, really cemented their relationship. You know, Shelley Winters is in that, and Susan Hubley, and Pat Hingle does a great job as Colonel Tom Parker, a hell of a lot better than Tom Hanks. I'm just saying. Damn good movie. And his TV work, we talked a little bit about of course, we didn't really talk about Body Bags, which I think is also really good. You know, but his TV work, check out his TV work too. And that's really
well, no,
where
TV
I want
TV work
to
is good, and Body Bags isn't my favorite, but Body Bags has some good stuff in it, and Carpenter appears on screen in it, which is always nice to see.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's where I want to go with it, okay?
Yep. So, Aaron, is there anything that you'd like to bring up before we get going?
Troy had mentioned that one of the bugaboos on Carpenter, popular bugaboos, is that he doesn't know how to end a movie. And I agree that that's usually, like, really overwrought, that it's just people wanting a closed ending. However, I think that one of the movies we've not really discussed yet, The Fog, suffers from a bad ending. That movie, for me, was on a top five trajectory until the last 15 minutes, and then it crashed and burned so hard that I don't know what happened. It's just like,
yeah.
What happened to this movie? It had so much going for it, and it died. I don't know
what
happened.
I remember you texting me and saying, okay, I just finished this movie. What the fuck happened there? Yeah, I have to say, you know, I don't remember if it was the last 15 minutes or if it was like the last half hour or so, but I do remember when I saw it. I honestly didn't see it for the first time until, God, about maybe 10, 12 years ago, and I've seen it twice. I just remember thinking, yeah, this is not bad. This is pretty damn good. And then all of a sudden, I didn't care. You know, it just lost me. So it's one of those things. So Troy, anything that you'd like to bring up or point out before we get going?
I don't really get the annoyance over the end of The Fog personally. I think it's fine. I don't have a problem with that film, although it took me a while to kind of warm to it. It was a complicated film in the sense that there was a lot of reshoots and there was a lot of tinkering that had to take place, and
I think the ending is perfectly fine. I think if I were to talk about a Carpenter film I really like that I think gets very confused and very very unsatisfying and clunky at the end, it would be Vampires. I like Vampires very much, but I don't think anybody really ever quite understood the whole reversal exorcism thing. Carpenter pretty much admits it on the commentary that, yeah, I never really understood that. It's like it kind of shows. The last act is very clunky and feels very just like it's in a big rush to just wrap everything up, which is disappointing because the rest of the film is so good. But that's really the only ending I can think of that I'd say, yeah, that was really not worthy of what came before it. The only other thing I would bring up that hasn't, you know, we've talked a little bit about the music. And, of course, you know, the thing about Carpenter is it doesn't matter whether it's one of his good films or one of his not-so-good films. The music is always good. I mean, his scores are always quite
effective. Very good music.
I love his music. I just think it has such a wonderful kind of atmosphere to it, and it works so well. And of course, occasionally he would have, you know, Ennio Morricone did the music for The Thing, and Jack Nietzsche did Starman, and you know, there were a few things that he didn't score, but for the most part, he scores his own films, and he does it extraordinarily well. Actually, probably my favorite overall Carpenter score is for a movie that he scored that he didn't direct, which is Halloween 3. I really love the score for that film. It's probably my overall favorite, along with Prince of Darkness. I love that score as well. But, I mean, there's no such thing as a bad John Carpenter score, so it's all relative.
Nope. But, you know, now something you mentioned a commentary, and that's what I want to say. I know it's an odd thing to mention, but one of the all-time great movie disc bonuses is the commentary for Big Trouble in Little China, which starts off mm-hmm. with John Carpenter and Kurt Russell talking about the movie, and they're saying, hey, I remember this and I remember that. But after about 15 minutes, maybe even more like 10 minutes, you get some really good movie stuff the first 10 or 15 minutes, and I mean specifically to the movie. And then all of a sudden it just becomes two friends who sound like they haven't seen each other in a few months, catching up and shooting the shit mm-hmm. and occasionally referring back to the movie. And it's just one of the most amazing commentaries ever because yeah. it's a look into two of the creative people on the film
right.
as people juxtaposed with the movie that they made together. And it's great.
Yeah, I wish they could have done a commentary. I wish they could have done a commentary for Escape from L.A. I think they were going to. Unfortunately, COVID happened, and, you know, that kind of put everything dead in the water. So Carpenter's commentaries yeah. are always really good. I've done a lot of commentaries myself, either by myself or with other people for various different Blu-ray and DVD versions. And I can tell you that they're tough to do. They take a lot of work, and I've always wanted to do a Carpenter film. I've never had an opportunity. I'd love to do one if I ever got a chance. But, man, I mean, the man has done commentaries for most of his own films, and they're always worth listening to.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's – you know, I have to say, you know, you just watch – listen to that. And anybody that wants to knock Kurt Russell or John Carpenter – as, yeah, this is all they do or this is all they can ever do. No. Nobody can have that much fun as just one thing. And that's just one of the – I mean, how often do you get that? That's not even a gimmick commentary track. It really sounds like they went there prepared to do this, you know, important-sounding commentary, and then just were like, you know what, fuck it, let's just talk. And I think that's awesome. I think that's very revealing about their personalities, and I think that says a lot about Carpenter's movies, too, and where he's coming from as a director.
Yeah, again, he's unpretentious, as I said before.
Okay.
And, you know, it's interesting. They're good friends. They're close friends, and they're very different politically. Carpenter's very leftist, and Kurt Russell is very much on the right. Escape from L.A. is actually an extremely left-wing movie, yet Kurt Russell was one of the producers on the film and had a hand in writing it.
So it clearly it speaks well to their ability to kind of set politics aside. Because I asked Carpenter that too, and also his wife. I said, you know, getting somebody on set like James Woods or Charlton Heston, what was that like? And they said it's like Thanksgiving dinner. You just don't talk about politics. You do your job, and you don't get into those topics. And they got along fine with both of them.
Yep. Well, you know, I think that's going to be a great place to end this. So I want to thank everybody out there for listening. I want to thank the three of you for coming on, especially you, Troy. It's been wonderful hearing everything. You know, hope to have you back at some point. But with that, you know, we said we wanted to bring this in at under 2 hours, and we have. So I think that this will be it. Now I just wish I had that little Carpenter cue from the end of Halloween to take us out on this. But instead, we'll just have to take it out on the count of three. So on the count of three, we will say goodnight. So one, two, three. Good night, folks.
Good night.